All right, so let's start with a little meditation. So everybody just, this is only a few minutes. You don't have to get super comfortable, but just allow your eyes to close, fully or partially, whatever's comfortable for you. So let's begin by simply listening to the sounds in the room. Just sitting in the midst of them. Letting them come to you. And now, in your mind's eye, find your own body in the room. And maybe welcome yourself into the room. Maybe greet yourself with an inner smile and an outer smile, if that feels right. Inclining toward yourself the way you might toward a good friend. Dropping your awareness into your body and noticing the physical sensations as they come and go. Pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral sensations. Particularly noticing any uneasiness in your mind or body. And seeing if you can let your heart soften a little because of this difficulty. Just letting your heart melt a little. And now gently open your eyes. So this little meditation was mindful self-compassion in a nutshell. We were stopping what we're doing, which is not something we often do. Just this act of stopping is really profound. Seeing what arises, which is mindfulness, and responding to any discomfort that we have with kindness, and that self-compassion. So like Ariana said, I'm Holly Sotvika. I teach mindful self-compassion here in Asheville, and I have a website that's mindfulselfcompassionasheville.com. I am a nurse practitioner and a health coach, a functional integrative nurse practitioner and health coach, and I have been meditating for a long time, and I always turned to meditation and mindfulness whenever, particularly when things were really difficult in my life. And it always provided relief and help. But there was continuously over decades, I was always bumping into walls and I couldn't figure out what it was. The deeper my meditation practice went, I would invariably get to this place where I was thinking, I'm not being mindful enough. I am still feeling pain. I am still suffering and I'm working so hard and I'm meditating 45 minutes a day. Why is this? Why am I still a mess? And what I know now that I didn't figure out for myself, it was actually learning about mindful self-compassion. Someone gave me permission through that to be mindful of my emotions, particularly of my pain. And it's crazy to me that I did not figure that out for myself, but it doesn't matter. Learning that that is part of mindfulness, to feel and go deeply into your own pain, it's such an amazing gift. And it's the door in all of those walls for me. Once I realized that I could do that, I realized that when I was using mindfulness to try to escape my pain, I was dishonoring my pain, dishonoring myself, right? And that I wasn't really being mindful. I was distracting. I was doing spiritual bypassing, which is, you know, what people, some of you might have heard of that. So anyway, it took, you know, a really particularly tough time for me in 2016. In early 2017, when I was really just suffering and the meditation wasn't cutting it, that I started listening to some guided meditations, and that's how I discovered mindful self-compassion. And it's just so profound to me. And there's so much science behind it. And being a science-y kind of person, it really appealed to me. So that's why I'm teaching it. So if you have paper and a pencil, grab that. If you do not, you don't need it. But we're going to do a short little exercise. So close your eyes again. This is very brief. Close your eyes. And think about various times in your life when you've had a close friend who was suffering in some way. Maybe not a family member, but somebody you really, really find dear. So they had a misfortune. They failed in some way. They felt inadequate. How do you typically respond to your friends in such situations? What do you say to them? What tone do you use? How is your posture? Are there any nonverbal gestures you might use? And if you have a pen and paper, you can open your eyes and write that down. If not, just sit quietly and continue holding this image. And when you're ready, close your eyes again if you've been writing. And now think about various times when you were suffering in some way. You had a misfortune, failed, or felt inadequate. How do you typically respond to yourself in these situations? What do you say? What tone do you use? What happens with your posture? Do you use any nonverbal gestures? And if you're writing things down, you can go ahead and open your eyes and jot down what you noticed about this. Do you notice the difference in how you respond to others and yourself? So now opening your eyes, everybody. So I usually do this as a participatory thing, but there are so many people that I can't really call on anybody. So I'm just going to ask you if you'd like to speak at any point when I ask for folks to speak, just to unmute yourself, and we'll just cross our fingers that people don't, you know, talk over each other. But if they do, it's no biggie. So does anybody have any reflections on this exercise that they'd care to share with the class? What did you notice any difference between the way that you respond to your friend and the way you respond to yourself? Whatever your experience was, it's your experience and it's completely valid. Not everyone has the same experience of in this noticing that you are more kind and more accepting of your friend's suffering than your own. But not, apparently 78% of the general population in the U.S. is more compassionate towards others than themselves. This is based on research done by Kristen Neff, and Kristen Neff is a researcher who is one of the two authors of this program, Mindful Self-Compassion. She started researching self-compassion as an alternative to self-esteem. She was a self-esteem researcher and found self-esteem to be very problematic. And she was also a meditator, and she had this wonderful teacher who had mentioned self-compassion, which I think is just pretty amazing because it's not something that was widely spoken about. I'd never heard of it actually in 30 years of being part of that kind of stuff. But so she saw that as an alternative and started researching it, and the program grew out of that. Anyway, 78% of the general population in the US is more compassionate towards others than themselves. It's part of our culture. 6% of people are more compassionate to themselves than others. And I've had folks in my course who spoke about these challenges as well. It sounds like it might be nice. It's apparently not. About 16% is equally compassionate to self and other. And, you know, our distance from our friend's suffering, our ability to have some perspective on it, allows for more compassion to arise, because it's a bit like mindfulness, you know, having a bit of a step back so that we can see how beautiful this person is when they're suffering. We can keep all of these things in perspective. So just having that little bit of space, and it's something that we can actually cultivate in our relationship with ourselves. It's not just mindfulness. There's more to it than that, but we can allow for some more perspective to arise for our own suffering, the way we have that with other people, if we happen to be in that majority group. But regardless, even if you have the opposite or the reverse, then you can work on this. These are skills that are learned, that we can learn. Mm-hmm. So based on this experience and based on some of this feedback that I've gotten from people, we can define self-compassion based on this, giving ourselves the kindness we would give a friend when things are tough. Or alternatively, treating ourselves the way we'd like others to treat us. You know, there are always people who could not give that to me. And it's really wonderful to be able to give it to myself and not have to run to the phone and call X person every single time that I can support myself and that I can, you know, enjoy relationships with people who maybe don't offer me the perfect compassion. Mm-hmm. So let's talk some more about defining self-compassion. So according to Kristen Neff, according to her research, she's identified three main components. So it's self-kindness, common humanity, and mindfulness. So self-kindness, as opposed to harsh self-criticism. Excuse me. So with self-compassion, we treat ourselves with kindness, care, understanding, and support, just like we would treat a friend that we cared about. But most people treat themselves much more harshly than this. Most people say things to themselves that they would never say to another person. And compassion is actually concerned with the alleviation of suffering. There's an action component to it. It's motivated to do something to relieve the suffering. So it could be, like Patty was saying, actively soothing and comforting yourself with things like petting your hair. There are so many different ways that we can soothe ourselves, but that is a part of self-compassion. And then the next component is common humanity, as opposed to isolating, which Patty also brought up. So with self-compassion, we see our own experience of imperfection as part of the larger human experience. And we recognize that everyone suffers, that it's actually normal to suffering, it's normal to suffer. And this actually, you know, when we're suffering, we tend to think like, everybody else is fine. I'm the broken one, you know, and it's very isolating to think this sort of thing. It creates a real sense of abnormality. And the ironic and also beautiful thing there is that even that experience of feeling like I'm the broken person in this universe, even that is universal. Even that is something that every person has felt. And you can even use that thought as an anchor to help you get back to feeling a sense of common humanity. Everybody's felt this. And it's so important. It really, really helps us. And mindfulness is the last component, as opposed to suppressing, avoiding, and on the other end of the spectrum, ruminating or over-identifying with our painful parts. So in order to respond to our suffering with compassion, we first have to know that we're suffering. And mindfulness allows us to turn toward our painful feelings, to see them, and to actually have a container, a cool container with which we can actually hold and tolerate our pain and suffering. Mindfulness is a balanced state of awareness. So we're not suppressing or avoiding what we're feeling, and we're not getting carried away completely by a dramatic storyline and just dwelling on that storyline for hours and hours, right? So that's rumination is what we call that. And we all do it, right? We all suffer. But mindfulness helps us to balance that state of awareness so that we can actually be with our pain. So kindness, common humanity, and mindfulness, these three components can be rephrased as loving, connected presence, which is another great way to define or describe self-compassion. So I mentioned before self-esteem, and I actually, if any of you are interested in this, this is one of the most interesting parts of this, intellectually most interesting parts of self-compassion work for me, and I wrote a blog post about it recently. All my blog posts are really short. So if you want to check that out on my website. The blog isn't very, my website, I haven't worked too hard on it, but in the upper right corner, I don't know my left or my right, in the upper right corner of my website, there's a little thing that says blog, and you can click there and it'll give you access to all of that. And my website's mindfulselfcompassionasheville.com. But anyway, self-esteem, as I said, Kristin Neff was a researcher, a self-esteem researcher before she got into the self-compassion work. And self-esteem can be defined as a global evaluation of a person's self-worth, their own evaluation of their self-worth. So judging themselves as good or bad, right? It's very broad, very global, good or bad. And it's often based on comparisons with others, feeling special, feeling above average, and it tends to be contingent on success. We need to be successful to have high self-esteem, right? Or we need to at least believe that we are. But self-compassion doesn't entail evaluations of good or bad. It simply involves relating to ourselves kindly, especially when we fail or notice personal shortcomings. So this means that self-compassion is always available. It doesn't desert us when we fail the way self-esteem does. And it fosters feelings of social connectedness rather than social comparison because we're not being competitive. We don't need to compete with others in order to feel self-compassion. We don't have to compare ourselves. And that self-esteem thing that we've all been taught, I was really, really taught that when I was younger, that we need to have that can really create a lot of disconnection in our relationships and problems, you know, interpersonal problems, because we're kind of approaching other people as if they're competing for worth. And that's just not necessary. So research done by Kristen Neff and many, many other people, there's a whole litany of, and there's a link on my website actually to all of this research. You can get full text articles of all the self-compassion research, which is pretty amazing. If you've ever been into research, you usually have to pay to get the full text article of anything, and it's not cheap. So this is a treasure trove. But research shows that compared with self-esteem, self-compassion is less contingent on things like physical attractiveness and successful performances, and it provides a more stable sense of self-worth over time. It's linked to less social comparison and less narcissism than self-esteem, and that's actually, narcissism was what my most recent blog post was about. So when a lot of people, I think including myself, hear the term self-compassion at first, it doesn't sound very good. It's a bit of a turnoff. There's something about that in our culture we're like, ooh, self-compassion, why would you do that? Not everybody, but a lot of people. Does anybody have any idea? Do you have any, you know, ideas about self-compassion maybe not being a good idea, or can you imagine what some of those thoughts might be? Indulgent. Yeah, and research shows that's very common. I think that's one of the first things I thought was, oh gosh, you know, am I just going to do mani-pedis all the time and just, you know, eat bonbons? Nobody eats bonbons anymore. I don't even know what a bonbon is. but research shows that self-compassionate people actually engage in healthier behaviors like exercise, eating well, drinking less alcohol, getting medical care when they need it. And compassion, if you think about it, a compassionate parent is not going to allow their child to stay up all night, every night playing video games and eating nothing but Cheetos and Skittles, right? A compassionate parent actually has the long-term view in their awareness. You know, that's their interest. It's a balanced prioritization of now and later. And similarly, when we're being self-compassionate, we're thinking about our long-term well-being, right? We're valuing ourselves the way we might a child. So any other ideas of things that might turn people off about this idea of self-compassion? Right, so this is a great one. So selfish, that self-compassion is selfish. And I think that was probably the main turnoff for me is that, you know, it has the word self in it, and that's just pretty taboo. I think that I was brought up feeling like that was taboo. But research shows that self-compassionate people tend to be more caring and supportive in romantic relationships. So this is a relief. And that self-compassionate people are more likely to compromise in relationship conflict, and they're more compassionate towards others. So by including themselves including ourselves in the circle of compassion, our sense of separateness and disconnection is reduced. Also, similar to this, a lot of people think that self-compassion is like self-pity. This is similar to both Patty and Laura's points. But research shows that self-compassionate people are more likely to engage in perspective taking rather than focusing on their distress, and that they're less likely to ruminate on how bad things are. So this was, you know, me growing up, I remember constantly, you know, whenever I was maybe giving myself self-compassion. I happen to think that it's kind of an instinct, but maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. But that I would hear people would say, you know, don't feel sorry for yourself, quit feeling sorry for yourself, that sort of thing. And there are all these messages that we get that can turn us away from and make us afraid of being compassionate with ourselves. But having compassion for yourself actually isn't self-pity. It's much sweeter than that. A lot of people think that self-compassion is weak. However, research shows that it actually increases coping and resilience in tough situations like divorce, trauma, and chronic pain. So this could be, you know, I wish that this was a prescription, you know, that practitioners wrote for people with chronic pain, for people who are going through divorces, for people who have PTSD, and pretty much anything. I think everybody should do it, but it's not weak. Is my point. It makes you stronger through making you more resilient. A lot of people think that self-compassion is like making excuses, avoiding responsibility. But research shows that self-compassionate people take greater personal responsibility for their actions, and they're more likely to apologize if they've offended someone. This is huge. I think that this is really, really a big, important thing. Self-compassion provides the safety that we need, the emotional safety that we need in order to admit our mistakes and to learn and to grow, rather than needing to blame someone else, so that we can continue loving ourselves, right? That's something that I was talking about in that recent blog post. And then a lot of people are afraid that if they're more self-compassionate, that will undermine their motivation to grow and improve themselves. But interestingly, research shows that self-compassionate people are no less likely to have high personal standards. They just don't beat themselves up when they fail. So they, as a result, they're less afraid of failure. They're more likely to try again. They're more likely to persist in their efforts after failing. So if you think about this, it does actually make sense. If you've ever had a harsh, critical boss or coach, think about how you performed under them. You know, you might have been a little when they came around. You were kind of, and you might have made mistakes because you were so afraid of how they would come down on you. And everybody's different, but you might be somewhat motivated under that. But then think about when you've had a really kind and supportive and compassionate coach or boss, how you performed with them. So again, we're talking about this having an emotionally supportive environment that's needed for change. And then additionally, people might be afraid of applying self-compassion because they're afraid of opening up to their pain. They're afraid of what we call backdraft in self-compassion. It's a firefighting metaphor, backdraft, but it's basically this, for firefighters, if there's a room with closed windows and doors and there's a fire in it, it will burn up all the oxygen and it will start to die down. But if you open the door, if you're a firefighter and you open the door to go fight the fire, the oxygen that rushes in through the door will cause the flames to leap, right? So it's very dangerous and they have to protect themselves from that. And firefighters protect themselves from backdraft by, rather than just ripping open a door, they poke holes in a wall to introduce small bits of oxygen, right, at a time, so that when they open the door, the flames won't leap out, right? And similarly, in self-compassion, we do this slowly. We do this with prudence, so that we keep ourselves safe, so that we can go towards the pain and put out the fire, right, address the fire. Without being re-traumatized. It's a really valid concern. But fortunately, in at least the eight-week self-compassion program that I teach, we do lots and lots of things to be very, very careful and always remember to adjust our level of engagement according to what's safe for us. And then a lot of people are afraid of self-compassion. I'm sorry, not afraid of self-compassion, but a lot of people want self-compassion, but they feel they don't deserve it. And, you know, this is a funny thing. Even after years of self-compassion work, I realized just the other day when I was teaching a class and I had to engage in a new exercise that I hadn't actually personally done before, that I'm in this category, right? I had no idea that I felt like that. But these feelings of not deserving our own compassion are, you know, can be very unconscious and can really hold us back from giving ourselves what we need. And it's also, for a lot of people, they want to do more of this. They want to give themselves self-compassion, but it's just hard to practice, right? We're busy. We have so much else going on, so many distractions. And this is all very valid. There are lots and lots of benefits of self-compassion. This is one of the reasons that I was so drawn to it. There's so much evidence supporting this practice. So self-compassion, not just the practice, but having the quality, right? And practicing it can help you to create this quality. It does. There's research that shows that you can teach yourself this. But having self-compassion is strongly linked with fewer negative states like depression, anxiety, stress, and shame, or fewer pathological states, rather. I don't like saying negative. It's associated with a more positive body image. It's linked to more positive states like happiness, life satisfaction, and optimism, or more pleasant states like happiness, life satisfaction, and optimism. And it's actually linked with better physical health. And research on the 8-week program that I teach shows that after the 8 weeks, folks experienced increases in self-compassion, mindfulness, and compassion for others, decreases in depression, anxiety, stress, and emotional avoidance, increases in social connectedness, life satisfaction, and happiness. And all these gains were maintained at a 1-year follow-up. But increases in self-compassion were linked to how much self-compassion practice the participants did, either days per week spent meditating or times per day spent doing the informal practice. And you do not have to take the 8-week course. Or there's also a workbook. I meant to grab that to show you all. But there's a workbook that you can buy. I would suggest you get it from your local bookstore. But these days, we can't shop locally so much. Well, you could, but you don't even have to do one of these things. You can go to Kristen Neff's website, which I link on my website, but it's self-compassion.org. And like everything is available free online. You can get all of the meditations, all of the core meditations from the program. You can do this at home for free. And also if you're interested in the 8-week program, you can contact me. Even if you can't afford it, we can figure it out. Anyway, so let's do another meditation. So get a little more comfortable. Now we'll be here a little longer. So settle in and allow your eyes to close partially or fully. Bring to mind a situation in your life that's difficult. Something that's causing you stress. And this is probably not a reach at this time. I'm sure you all can easily think of something. So it could be this societal issue that we're all working through. Could be a health problem, a relationship problem, work problem, financial problem, maybe a friend who's struggling. And please choose a problem in the mild to moderate range, not a big problem. Just reminding you of when I was speaking about backdraft, right? We don't want to overwhelm ourselves as we're first learning the skill of self-compassion. So allow yourself to see, hear, and feel your way into the problem to the extent that you experience some uneasiness in your body. Where do you feel it the most? Make contact with the discomfort that you feel in your body. And then say to yourself, slowly and kindly, this is a moment of suffering. That's mindfulness. You might instead want to say something like, this hurts, or this is stressful, this is grief. You might want to name the particular emotion, or you might want to say something as general as just ouch. And now say to yourself, suffering is part of living. This is common humanity. Other options include, I'm not alone. Others are like me. We all struggle in our lives. This is how it feels when a person struggles in this way. Now putting your hands over your heart or another place that feels soothing. Feeling the warmth and gentle touch of your hands. Say to yourself, may I be kind to myself. that's self-kindness. You might say, may I give myself what I need? May I accept myself? Or may I live in love? And if you're having difficulty finding the right words, imagine that a dear friend or loved one is having the same problem as you. What would you say to this person heart to heart? If your friend were to hold just a few of your words in their mind, what would you like those words to be? What message would you like to deliver? Can you offer the same message to yourself? Slowly open your eyes. So does anybody care to share something about their experience? You can just unmute yourself and speak if you'd like to. Did you notice anything after saying the first phrase, "This is a moment of suffering"? Did you notice any shift? Just in saying that, this is a moment of suffering. So for me, a lot of times, just this one thing, just this first thing, recognizing, what I'm feeling is just an enormous validation. I am being seen. Somebody sees me, right? It's just so, so powerful just to see yourself. And, you know, you bring up such a good point about when we do validate ourselves, just like when we're validated by somebody else, it can open up a floodgate, right? Or we can see it as we're undamming a river, right? We're allowing some flow, we're restoring flow, right? Because I really believe, I've experienced this. I know that pain has a very healthy role in our lives. And when we allow it to flow, when we allow it to be connected, when we deal with any disconnection that we've learned or that we have because we're overwhelmed, then we really restore our own ability to benefit from pain. we give it space to be. So did anybody notice any shifts with the second phrase? Suffering is part of life. Everyone suffers. This is how it feels when people go through something like this. Did anybody notice a difference there? So this one, this part is specifically about restoring our sense of abnormality, reminding ourselves that especially in our moments of pain and suffering, we are human, we are normal and healthy humans, right? And that we are not alone. I like to remind myself when I'm really suffering, not just this is how it feels when someone suffers in this way, but there are so many people on this planet who are feeling just like this right now. You know, connecting with my compassion for those other people helps me to realize what I deserve, right? And then the third phrase, may I be kind to myself? And there are so many different things that you could have said here to yourself, but does anybody care to share about that? For me, just that, I just stick with the may I be kind to myself. That is enough. That's such a huge thing just to say, may I be kind to myself. It's saying that is a kind, that is kind. May I be kind to myself. And just, you just have this shift of feeling. You change, like, I'm going to approach this with kindness. You know, I'm just going to feel that, you know, just feeling that sweetness towards yourself is a huge, huge thing. So this, I hope that this exercise, this meditation was helpful, a helpful illustration for you all in how turning towards your pain can be really valuable and not as dangerous and, you know, not something that we need to really prohibit, something that we can really go towards our pain. So this is a really lovely thing. You can find this on lots of places, Kristen Neff's website where she has, it's called Self-Compassion Break. You can find it in lots of places. So Google that. Lots and lots of people do this guided meditation. So you can sit and formally do it the way we did. It can be done easily in 5 minutes as well. And it's also an informal practice that you can do. I do it all the time. Just I'll be talking with somebody like, and I'm feeling something, then I'll, you know, this is a moment of suffering and everyone suffers. May I be kind to myself? I just do it right then and there. And that's how fast it is. I'm really, really appreciative. And I'm really, really deeply grateful to all of you who joined this meeting and did this for yourself and all the people in your lives.